Sorry, started recording late. I'm on question 5 of the solutions. So assume that Firefox has a memory corruption vulnerability in its parsing of locally stored bookmarks. How could an attacker exploit such a vulnerability? This one was pretty easy, right? They just have to bookmark the page. And when you bookmark the page, that's when you can, you know, put data into the bookmarks file. And so anytime the bookmarks file gets parsed, that would potentially be when the attack happens. Now, of course, if the attacker was really going to do something like that, you'd want them to, you bookmark the page, the first time the bookmark file gets read, you do the compromise, and then you modify the bookmark file to get rid of your attack. Because oftentimes these exploits are very fragile. It causes your browser to crash, it won't leave evidence, so you get rid of it. And so, because now you had control of the browser, and so now you make the changes you want so you can be persistent. Stored file, so data that's stored on disk. So the reason why I was asking about this is because, what the heck? Data stored on disk is often from untrusted sources. So just because it's stored on disk does not mean it's trusted. It means, you know, it may or may not be. Depends on where the data came from.
Okay,
so backdoors. Why are backdoors hard to discover? This is just about a backdoor is a soft, it is code that adds an extra feature. From the perspective of, you know, you trying to find it, it's just like finding a bug. Except the bug was created by someone who's trying to hide the bug. It's one thing to find bugs where people aren't trying to obfuscate them, but when they're actually obfuscated, how are you going to find it? Especially because it's not like you have a test case. Most bugs you can remove once you have a test case. And the nature of backdoors is you don't know what the test case is. And if someone's good, they make it so when you read the code, you can't figure out how it would be triggered.
I said that backdoors are hard to find because when you find them, you think they're logic errors or logic bugs. So you don't know what their backdoor is.
That's probably good for full credit. But the thing the reason they look like logic errors,
yes,
if it's actually a backdoor, is because they were hidden.
Yeah.
And the ways in why an attacker would hide them is because it's not just a logic error. It has to be a subtle logic error. Because if it's an obvious logic error, then someone doing a reading through the code says, oh, that doesn't make any sense, and they fix it.
Not even knowing if there's a backdoor, does that add to why it's hard to find?
Yes. But even if you know there's a backdoor in something, people know. People are, I know they got in somehow. Where is it? I don't know. It's like, it's crazy.
I wrote that it because they can take on so many different forms and look so vastly different that it's difficult for search tools to find them. Is that a?
Yep. That's also. A lot of these questions, these are definitely more open-ended questions. Some of these things, and so yeah, there's. I wouldn't like one answer. I'm looking to see, do you understand what a backdoor is? That's really what I'm looking for here. And I don't want you to just regurgitate to me a definition. Because what's the point of memorizing? I mean, you only understand a definition when you use it. If you understand what a backdoor is, you go like, wow, yeah, that's hard to understand. There's lots of reasons why it is. And all these things that you're saying are all related. You know, these aren't distinct things. It's that someone put some code. So put something in there that's hidden. And so now, what do you look for? I don't know, it could be all kinds of things. It could be all kinds of characteristics. It could be, you know, you don't have a test case. You know. Yeah, you get the idea. So where I would want to take off marks is like, it was clear, but you don't know what a backdoor is. Or you start telling me, well, you know, actually it's not so hard. You can just put signatures for it and it's no problem. That would be. Hardware virtual machines. So, what kind of attacks do hardware virtual machines as VirtualBox mitigate? So, really, a virtual machine is kind of a kind of security mechanism, but it kind of isn't. It's really a way of running running an OS in its own little entity. And so what you're really doing is the equivalent of a sacrificial box. It's just that you can create and destroy them very easily. But they're not normally so lightweight that you can just create. Like, if they were really lightweight, every time you got a web request, you could spawn off a new virtual machine, have it handle the web request, and then destroy it. Booting up a whole OS for individual web requests is probably not a good idea. So, but it is useful if, say, you're wanting to run some, like, you want to install a program, and you're not sure if it's dodgy, or you're saying, I need to use this program. It might have some other bad software with it, but I need to use it. So you install it in a virtual machine. You run it there, and then when you're done, you blow the virtual machine away. Or instead of just blowing it away, what you'd actually do is like have it snapshot itself and revert to a snapshot, so you undo any changes to it. So this is, it's a great way. Virtual machines are most useful for running potentially malicious code. But it's an isolation mechanism. Separates your separates you know, one OS from the other. But that also makes it a bit of a problem, because now you can bring up entire operating systems on the fly. And what could be running in that operating system? Who the heck knows? And think about the problem Amazon has. And think of how much, someone steals a credit card number, goes to Amazon and says, I would like 10,000 virtual machines. And they say, sure. And all of a sudden they are, you know, using those. I mean, think about it. I mean, I kind of wonder how much crypto mining is happening using stolen credit cards right now in the cloud. Because think about it. You know, you're like, how am I going to monetize these credit card numbers? I mean, because credit card numbers are all traced, there's frauds, there's charges. Like, you know, you have to go somewhere and go to a real ATM. But here with, you know, these things, you just mine it on these things. Those are as legit as any other ones, and now you just claim it to the regular means of destroying stuff from cryptocurrencies. I mean, virtual machines make computation on demand. And so that flexible, anything that gives the defender a very powerful tool in general gives the attacker a very powerful tool.
I wrote that they might reduce the attack surface in some ways. Like if you have a SAS card that has a really fat attack surface and then you hide it behind like a small iSCSI driver or something like that.
So the idea is that you have the nasty stuff in a virtual machine and then just have like a...
Well, no, you have the nasty stuff on the hypervisor and then it hides it behind a little wrapper layer.
Hmm.
Like a software driver instead of like directly.
Right.
And
a virtual machine isn't necessary. You could just do that with a kernel level driver anyway. And the way I would normally do it is with a user space driver
right. With
some sort of interface if you really want. But then again, why not just put it in a process and just make a regular network interface for it. I mean, the main thing you want is maybe that code, you don't want it accessing other things in your system, so you want a sandbox. A hardware virtual machine is a very heavy sandbox. That's in effect what it becomes. That very heavy sandbox is useful in the sense of lets you run lots of, you know, things, and you know, you has a full environment, has access to everything. You kind of know that normally should be able to access anything outside of it. Although there are vulnerabilities in virtual machines. There are things that let you, your code, discover that they're running inside a virtual machine. And there's stuff that lets you break out of a virtual machine. The bugs in VirtualBox and VMware, those things exist. You could talk about that as a new security problem in this context, because how do you break out of hardware? You're normally getting more access to, like, what does it mean to break the hardware? You can't normally do that on most systems. But there's a virtual machine. There is actually a layer down there. And if you break into that, now all of a sudden you have maybe hundreds of virtual machines you can access. Because normally different virtual machines running on a given host are not trust each other. The hypervisor is supposed to isolate them. If you have questions about how this stuff works, please do ask. But,
looks like you got ratted. You keep getting a new tab opening.
What?
For the See You Learn keeps popping up.
Is there like a, one of those nasty USBs?
I haven't used any USB things. Oh, there's other browsers running.
Yeah, and it keeps opening up on the ghost.
Okay. What's this?
They're really happy about that.
We want to make sure you know about it, so there's one keep that opening up the tab.
Yeah, that's really. I wonder. Well, you know, IT support isn't in right now. They're all on strike.
Perfect opportunity.
So it's like, I don't.
Could it be someone's experience?
So.
I experiences for violating laws that put you in jail. I don't do that. I'm not saying it's not tempting. I don't say, but just no. Don't. No felonies, please.
Not even misdemeanors, please. No. No. Okay, so I mean, the virtual machine question, I think, is a little bit vague. Certainly for the midterm, I'm going to have to add something a little more precise. A lot of these questions are pretty vague. So the midterm will be easier in many ways than the assignment, simply because it'll be more precise. But in order to do well in the midterm, you should have a good understanding of the concepts behind these questions. If you just took a question, Googled, got some text, and put it into the solutions, you might actually get most credit for some of these things. That doesn't mean you understand it, and you're going to be in big trouble come to, the test. So don't do that. Or if you did do that, go back and try actually understanding the questions you actually didn't understand. So, what's the key advantage of mandatory access control? I haven't written up this. So what's the advantage of mandatory access control?
The system administrator has full control of everything. Get all the permissions.
Not exactly. It's not about system in control.
It's more locked down because each user has a level of access, and then everything has a level of access that you need to actually acquire that information.
So, partially, what's the real difference between mandatory access control and discretionary access control? There's just one fundamental difference between the two.
Is it how users can modify file permissions?
It's how users can modify the access controls. When you have mandatory access control, you cannot change the access control while the system is running. That's the fundamental thing about mandatory access control, is no one's changing it once it's up. So the advantage of that is an attacker gets onto the system, they cannot gain privileges to the point where they can change the access controls. That it's to precisely stop folks from, if I don't care what, it's exactly like in a convenience store, they say, I can't give you any money. The safe is on a timer. Come in the morning and then I can give you the money, but I can't give it to you in the middle of the night because it's locked. It's that kind of thing. It's like, I don't care if you've broken in, you can't do anything. The access you have is the access you have by getting that process, you're not going to be able to escalate it. That's the advantage of mandatory access control. That's the disadvantage of mandatory access control, because that's a very annoying way to maintain a system. Because it means that every time you want to change anything related to access, you have to basically shut the machine down, go into a special mode where you can change the permissions, and then start it back up. That's what it means. That's why when you Google SE Linux, which is the most common mandatory access control mechanism I know kind of in use, which is for for Linux systems, the most common thing people Google is how to turn it off. Because once it's running on a system, if it's actually enforcing, a lot of times when you have SE Linux running, it's not actually enforcing permissions, it's just warning you. It's basically saying, I would have stopped you from doing this, but I'm just warning you right now. But if it's an enforcing mode where it's going to stop things,
You can't do anything to the system while it's running.
I mean, those permit those that access is the access. You cannot run chmod. Or you can run chmod, it just will ignore you. I mean, it's that's the thing I want you to get out, mandatory access control. And it's annoying. It's just amazingly sysadmin hostile to run mandatory access control. Because basically what you're literally telling is the sysadmin, we don't trust you. So you can't change the system while it's running. Yeah. And then what I wanted you to do is for an operating system, answer the following questions. So for most systems, A is pretty simple. What do you do? How do you verify the integrity of the initial operating system install? It's the disk image. You get an ISO or a disk image or something from some source. That's supposed to be, you have to make sure that's authentic. And the most common way you do that is by checking the hash of it. So you go, there's a website saying, oh, this is what it should be, and you do that. And also, if you want to, you check the digital signature on it. A lot more, like for Linux distributions, it's all digitally signed and things. For Microsoft, they do give out hashes of their disk images. Apple, I don't think they do that because normally you have to download the OS installs through their app store. But by downloading it through their app store, they have the same integrity mechanisms they have for installing any application. So the basic, when you first install it, you have to make sure that initial media that you have is protected. And then hopefully you do this on a system that isn't compromised, because otherwise it could change the image on the fly while you create the boot disk. So, but I was normally looking for you just checking the hash. Then how's the integrity of software updates verified? Pretty much the same, except the differences is normally they're digitally signed, and the updates are digitally signed, and thus the public key of the signer is embedded in the OS image. So, you know, for Ubuntu, the Ubuntu image has Ubuntu signing keys that they use to verify packages. Particularly, what they do is they verify the package list. And the package list has hashes of all the individual packages. So if the package list is properly signed, you can then verify that any individual package hasn't been modified. So that's why in an Ubuntu system, you can get weird errors if for some reason the keys expire or something when you do an update of the package list. You say, well, I can't verify the package list because that's the basis of protection. And then similarly, Windows, they digitally sign their stuff. But the idea there is when you do the initial OS install, you don't have a base of trust. You're kind of almost in a SSH kind of thing of saying, I'm just going to download something and verify it and kind of make it. When you're updating, a key has been put into the system, one or more keys, and those provide a root of trust for further changes. And then are third-party applications given the ability to modify the operating system? If you're talking about iOS or Android, not really. Actually, the core OS is pretty locked down. For Android, you can do enough modifications that you can basically take over the phone if you give enough permissions. But I don't believe you can actually modify the OS, even if you give all the permissions. I don't think. I'd have to look. There might be some really crazy permission. But in general, you know, the system might be there, but hey, you're giving away so many privileges, who cares? You know, they already, you know, are just watching everything you do and you want the phone. On iOS, third-party packages don't have that kind of access. But on most desktop operating systems, when you install a package, the package is installed with full administrative access, and so it can modify anything as part of the package install, because the installer runs with full access. This is true on Windows, this is true on Linux, Mac OS. I mean, now that is changing because, you know, Microsoft has an app store, and those packages, I think, aren't supposed to install with full root privileges. They have some
delegation there. And Linux systems now have Snap and Flatpak, which is supposed to allow you to install packages without root access. It's supposed to be isolated. So it may be a privileged daemon running it, but the actual installer code doesn't run with full privileges. So Windows does have some weird things that lets it repair changes to the Windows directory, because traditionally Windows applications would go in and modify DLLs and everything, and so Windows can kind of detect a lot of those things and repair them. But it's really very ad hoc. It is more for compatibility. It's not a complete security mechanism. You can still mess with it and completely corrupt a Windows install. So that's where, and then how's the OS, what is one way the OS protects itself from modification by third parties? Yeah. For Ubuntu and stuff, doesn't have any protection. You can do what you want when you download something, as long as you have administrative. Well, one thing is, you have to have administrative access to install things. That's a basic protection. Another is to make sure that things are signed by trusted entities. Microsoft public things, you install something, it says, oh, here's this application. It's been signed by X. Whoa.
Yeah, there's something running that's opening.
Yeah. That's really weird. And it's like, it's a really weird kind of...
It's been doing like certain part of your login. It's like open up your Windows.
Probably in your login script.
Oh, this is, I don't have any privileges on this thing, so I can't do much.
Is it a touch screen?
No. Wait. Is it a touch screen? Oh, yeah, it is a touch screen.
Oh, it's like
maybe somehow, I mean, but
oh,
how?
Explain it on the taskbar. You have PowerPoint, Chrome, Google.
Yeah, maybe.
But how am I tapping that? I'm not.
It could just be a wear and tear.
Oh, me banging into the table.
Mm-hmm.
Before you punch the screen.
We should explain all the browser windows and the
stuff. Yeah, I just that's really lame. Okay. But that's okay, that's yeah, it is a touch screen. Okay. See. Yep. That's don't assume computer weirdness is always security things. Security is what it is if you've eliminated all other possibilities. Computers act weird for lots of reasons. Most of the time when people say, I think my computer's infected, I go look at it. No.
Oh, I was just thinking, I wonder if you could turn that into a vulnerability, like waiting for one of the taskbar things to pop up and then taking advantage of
it. Oh, I'm sure you could. It's okay, no worries. Yeah. But then the question is, how would you prevent it? How would you defend against it?
Fix your screen.
Fix your screen. Yeah. Okay, so was this assignment hard?
No.
Okay, good.
It wasn't difficult. I had a bit of trouble trying to identify what you were looking for some of the questions. But,
yeah.
Right, because it was, you know, like, explain what a certificate is. Well, geez, like, there's a lot that goes into...
But that's why I have the second sentence there.
Exactly, so. Yeah. So, but I think overall it wasn't too difficult, but it was more... The hard part was figuring out what you were looking for.
Yeah. Which was part of the point. The reason being is if I make very precise questions on assignments, I get very Googleable answers. Ones that require you to interpret, make you actually have to think about the question, are better as study aids. I don't want that. They'll be more precise on the midterm. So it shouldn't be so much ambiguity. I purposely, I'm trying to make it so that you have to think about the concept more and what's really going on with these things. I guess I'm leaning again. I think something about like being right here, maybe.
It's just the bottom half of the touch screen. It's like, what if you move the taskbar to the top?
Okay, now we're just over-engineering things. I'm done with, I think I'm done with this. So there's this. Any questions on assignment one? Let's see. So assignment one's here. Now's your time. otherwise I can.
Would there be anything on assignment one that we should study for midterm? Anything in particular?
Assignment one.
All right.
I'm
looking for clues.
The clues are: I take assignment one and assignment two questions, I put them into a document, and I hack on them. That's what I do to make the midterm. Now, that hacking on them sometimes means rewriting them, sometimes means kind of changing around, kind of going, okay, what is this? But that's the process by which I create the midterm. That way, I kind of stay close to what I've actually asked you about. So, I'm not saying they won't necessarily get a little things that are kind of, it's not exactly the material on the midterm, on the assignments, but it's trying to get the same concepts that are on the assignments. So, what I would suggest doing for studying is going, what's the concept each of these questions asking about? And then saying, do I have fuzziness about them? It's like, what I say, Unix has users and group IDs. From the kernel perspective, users and groups are labeled by what kernel level extraction. So you think, what am I asking here? Do I understand Unix permissions? You know, are there things that I kind of go like, I don't understand about Unix permissions? If there are things you feel like, you don't go look at that up. You know, that's also like here, sticky bit. This is all, I mean, this is all like, I didn't ask about, you know, some other aspects of this, of the Unix security model, and I won't be being overly picky about it, but I'm going to ask about the Unix security model. That's what much of this is. Actually, that's like the first like seven questions here. TCP wrappers, host-based firewalls, basically firewalls, what do they do? You know, TCP wrappers. TCP wrappers is kind of a fun little, you know, I like TCP wrappers in terms of just thinking about it in relationship to host-based firewalls and other firewalls, because it's a generic defense that's actually application level. And there's a number of mechanisms that do things inside an application, but they're all like very application specific. But TCP wrappers is, you load this library, you add this library to your app, and then you get this. VPNs. I mean, assignment one is Unix permission model, VPNs, firewalls, and related things. So, if you have a pretty good understanding of those things, you're fine. And again, I have to make specific questions, so they might be specific things, but I don't tend to like ones that just require memorizing.
Are they all going to be short answer, or are you going to have like true, false,
multiple
choice kind of format?
It's going to be mostly short answer. A few other ones, but I don't like multiple choice and like true, false. From a teaching perspective, because people who really know their stuff can generally do well, but actually, there's problems on both ends, because people who really know their stuff can often read the question and realize there's some little case I haven't accounted for, and the process of making it that precise to account for all those things is very hard, and often makes it harder for people who have less understanding to understand the question. Because there's a lot of little corner cases and other things, so you have to make it very precise to have a really correct answer in those sort of questions. So you mess up people who potentially really know the material and mess up people who don't know the material very well. So it's, I mean, if you ask lots of these questions, yes, you can get people to do this, but I'd rather just have you tell me about it. And also I think that's more, you have to actually, it's not recall, it's you have to create something, so I think it's a better test of what you know. It's a pain in the butt to grade, I will agree. But you know, I do this in operating systems. I can do it in this class. Other questions?
About how many? Like 15, 20?
About. I'm still. I mean, I've got a basic outline thing right now, but I'm still tweaking it. I expect a lot of you should be done in half an hour. Half an hour, 40 minutes. I can certainly give you ones where you have to write lots more, but it's just, yeah. So I don't expect you to have time pressure on this. For those of you who have PMC accommodations, I assume the strike's going to run through Wednesday now. So I will make arrangements to have another room, and we'll have at least a TA there to do things, and we'll do our best to kind of meet things.
I don't think the exam center is affected.
Hmm? It isn't?
I don't think so.
No, I emailed PMC earlier, and it seems that if the accommodations are already made, you're fine. I don't know.
It's already made, yeah. Huh. I will investigate and check. So that's something that'll make my life easier. Other things? I kind of want to talk about new material, but I kind of don't want to overwhelm you all with stuff before Wednesday.
Can you just go over the first assignment a little bit?
What do you want to know? Yeah, exactly. Assignment one was pretty easy. I think assignment two isn't that hard either. I don't like tests. I need to do something to keep you honest and make sure you're at least kind of paying attention. I've actually tested you all, but especially for I've been kind of trying to think about how I wanted to run a class like this, and kind of going like I was wanting something a little more of an experience than kind of like, okay, you need to do this, because I don't think actually what's currently known in security is actually that good. If that makes any sense. Current practice of security is crap. It's just a fact. And we know this because we see the results. It's not like anyone keeps their system secure. They all break. Horribly. Even organizations that supposedly manage best practice, you find out, oh, they got broken into.
Wasn't there that UK certificate authority where the CEO emailed 23,000 private keys?
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm not saying there aren't dumb things there, but honestly, the entire certificate model for browsers is fundamentally broken. Fundamentally. Netscape came up with it back in the day because they wanted to support credit cards. And really? If you just want to make sure you're sending credit cards, you just kind of want to make sure that wherever you sent the credit card to, like they, you know, no one else along the line did. But are you actually interacting with a valid merchant? And honestly, the modern model doesn't give you any assurances that you actually sent it to someone who's actually going to take care of your credit card. And once they get your credit card, who knows what they're going to do with it? There are proposals for doing things much more securely. With credit card numbers on the internet, and they never got adopted because they never figured out the usability parts. That's all SSL is supposed to provide. And it kind of does that, but the notion of you actually knowing who you're talking to, that's all broken. I think I made that clear at this point. So what I really want to do after the midterm is talking about, okay, how are we going to fix all this mess? What are the possibilities? And that's when we start talking about things like intrusion detection and diversity. So, any questions about biology from last week?
Are there any systems in place or research being done on creating like virtual T cells to go on?
My dissertation 20 years ago was about something related to that. I have. Well, that's not my dissertation was 20 years ago. It was less than that. But yeah, my early work was all published 20 years ago. Yeah, so. I'll try explaining what kind of things are. It's, we'll start on that on Monday. Yeah, I think if there are any other questions, I think I'll just let you guys go.
Are there going to be biology questions on the midterm?
No.
Okay.
No. I would say, I'm not, the final exam might have something a little bit, but it probably more like a bonus question. But, nothing yet, no. As I said, I've defined the scope with the assignment. So.
Huh?
Name 13 different types of rotations.